My guest today is Paul Adams, Chief Product Officer at Intercom, which is the leading AI customer service company. Paul Adams helped grow Intercom from a 14-person team to over a 1,000-employee company. Before joining Intercom, Paul worked in leadership and product at Facebook and Google. For full disclosure, a Fundrise fund has invested in the company, therefore has a financial interest in their success. Any discussion of a portfolio company is not intended to imply that the investment was or will be profitable, or that such a company is representative of all investments held by the fund. Past performance is not indicative of future results. Before we get started, I want to remind you that this podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only and does not constitute investment advice or a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Paul Adams, welcome to Onward.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me on.
So Intercom's, I think, the leading or one of the top five leading AI applications in the world. And you guys were one of the first to adopt it. You've been a fast iteration. You've done a lot of work on the application layer. So I'm interested to hear how you think about a software company sitting on top of an AI model, whether it's your model or another model. Even if you build your own model, you have to compete with the AI research labs. How do you think about that as like a long-term or even mid-term competitive business?
There's probably lots of ways to answer that question. The shortest answer is no one knows. So we've kind of gone through this journey, I think, over the last few years where at times the model layer companies were going to reap all the rewards. And then other times they're screwed. When it's kind of like oscillated over time, we've seen advances in the model's capabilities slow down and then speed up. And I think the place we're at today is that clearly the models are not in a place right now where they're going to stop in any significant way. We've all been using Claude Code quite heavily recently inside Intercom, and I could think, blows my mind. It's still, I think, fairly early in that journey. If you listen to Anthropic talk about it, talk about coding and then tool use and computer use. So I think we can expect that the model layers will continue to get better and better and better. But at the same time, they're general models. They're built for general applications and applicability. And for the longest time, since the very, very beginning of Finn and Finn's development, we've invested in the AI layer and we've invested in the model layer, the RAG system layer and then the model layer. And we started training our own models and taking open source models at Qwen and seeing if we could train them ourselves and use our customer conversation history and see if that improved performance. And we've seen great results there. So actually these days, the Finn product is at all levels of the stack. We have the application layer, we have the RAG layer, and we have the AI model layer. We still use Anthropic quite heavily for lots of different things, but lots of Finn now runs on our own Finn models that we've trained ourselves. So I think we'll continue to invest in all three layers. Will the app layer get commoditized? Will there be durable value there? I don't know, but certainly it's going to become a lot easier to clone other people's products and clone other people's features. It's going to become easier to build competitors that are like quite feature-rich quite quickly. So I don't know how durable that layer is going to be. Now, you have to still build the right product and know that you're solving real customer problems. And it's quite easy to clone the mistakes as it is to clone the things you got right. I don't know. I think no one knows. Our strategy for this is to invest in all three layers simultaneously and then be well set up no matter how this plays out. But certainly, I think the model layer is going to be like an important differentiator for a lot of companies like ours in the future.
I can totally see why you train or build your own model. It's going to be better at your narrow job to be done, at least for the foreseeable future. It's such a hard thing to reason about because in a certain amount of time, a lot of the customers coming to you will be other AI agents. And then how do you talk to another AI about the problems it's trying to solve for its customer? It's very meta.
It's very meta. Again, it's so hard. Things are moving so fast. It's a wild time to work in software. I've had a long career. This is the wildest time I've ever experienced. So it's very difficult to predict the future, but you kind of have to assume that individual people and consumers will have a personal agent. And you have to assume that they're going to give that agent things to do. So the agent will go and talk to whomever, businesses, Finn. So it's certainly the case, I think, that we will have agent-to-agent communication. But I think you'll see people in there too. There's a lot of talk about this topic often goes towards efficiency. hey, it'll just be way better and more efficient for your life if you get your agents to do your shopping. And then I'm like, yeah, but people like shopping. People love shopping. It's a hobby. So I think you'll still see people in it at times. But yeah, we'll have to see how it plays out.
Seems like you're maybe a contemporary of mine. And I remember, I watched the internet show up. Just to give you some background on me, at one point I was in the retail development business building and buying malls. So that was 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago. And I'm just digressing here, but the internet's mid to late 90s. The mall business and the retail business actually like peaked 2007. Arguably, tech people would have argued it was dead. And 10 years later, it's peaking. The Fed calls it long and variable lags. How does actually the diffusion problem happen? Who changes? What changes? You could have a really big business for a big part of the population that doesn't adopt or adopts only narrowly AI models and agents. They're not going to like agents.
I used to say this when I was at Facebook a very long time ago. History repeats, maybe, if some version of history repeats. And I was saying the same stuff I said back then. But I used to tell people back then, when Facebook was kind of peaking and the Facebook app was peaking, it was really cool to be there. But I used to say that technology changes fast and people change slowly. Just human psychology, it's encoded in us for thousands of years. So I think you'll see organizations will change much more slowly than people might imagine, even when the technology races ahead. Certainly, I think people will be left behind at times. But there's just a lot of institutional friction. And the same for people's personal lives. In the same way the shopping malls lasted or peaked or did well. And some still do well, I think, today, depending on where you are in the world. So I think things that people do today that you might expect to be completely destroyed by AI might last a lot longer than people realize.
Sorry, I'm just using retail as a metaphor here or an analogy. So what happened to retail, because I know a lot about this, is that it got destroyed. So my favorite deal is there's a mall outside Washington, D.C. Somebody bought it in 2015 for $200 million. And in 2017, it was foreclosed on for $90 million. Somebody bought it and then got foreclosed on again. And it went to $6 million by 2019. And now, literally 2026, what's left of retail actually is doing well. Once you cleaned out, you had too much retail because people shifted to buying on the internet. And so there was this period where you had to reduce a lot of capacity, but now you ended up with the right amount and that right amount does really well. But that transition for retail, there's like a 15-year period where essentially the world discounted it to almost zero.
It's a good analogy. I think it's quite easy to imagine that happening to how companies are structured and what people do with their day every day. A ton of things I think are going to change quite dramatically.
You saw yesterday that Block announced that they're laid off 4,000 people, like almost half the staff. Do you have a take on that?
No one other than Jack and the Block team know what's going on inside. It sounded like they'd hired very aggressively over the years prior and during COVID. So there's people saying, hey, the company had just too many people full stop. And it wasn't some radical adoption of AI inside the company that suddenly made all these people less necessary. And the stock price jumped. So I think people are going to latch on to this idea that, oh, hey, if you lay off a ton of people, you can juice your stock price. But I think there's more to the story than that. Potentially, the strategically looking forward, AI was one of the primary reasons why. But I think there's more to it. The company sounds like there's a lot of people in it. But again, only the Block team and the leadership team know.
Our company is nothing like Intercom, but in some ways it actually is similar to Intercom. So we started around 2012. We built a decent sized business, which was a democratizing investing in real estate. Real estate peaked in 2021. Intercom probably peaked in 2021 too. For us, so the real estate collapsed in the United States, probably the world. Interest rates went up, there was oversupply, went through this really down period. We refounded the business and expanded from real estate to investing in tech companies. We built a real estate AI platform called Real AI, and we rebuilt our business again. And Intercom did that as well. And I have thoughts and lessons about how to refound a business because real estate is cyclical. So real estate will come back. It's coming back. It's not the same as Intercom where technology waves disrupt the old wave. So both industries are cyclical, but in different ways. So I'm really interested to hear that journey story because I'm very empathetic with it. And I'm also have probably different questions to ask about it because I've lived it. And so I'm like, oh, okay, interesting. How do you deal with this problem versus that problem? Can you tell me the arc and then I can dig into different pieces of it?
I'll try and give you the shortest version possible. Like you said, we were founded in 2011. a SaaS company, very successful for the first 8-9 years of our life. We kind of went down the IPO path, and it didn't IPO in the end. We had a date, and then the whole market went sideways, and the whole thing closed, but kind of a blessing in disguise, honestly. And through that process of IPO, I think we just got very unfocused. And to kind of sell an IPO, you need to be painting some big, grandiose picture. We got very strategically loose, I think. And as a result, our business started declining. So Owen, our co-founder and CEO, came back as CEO, and 2 months later, ChatGPT showed up. So that was the pivotal moment. It's literally 3-4 days of that, the 3 to 4 days, maybe a week after ChatGPT, that set us on an entirely new path. And we now look back on a couple of internal docs saying, this is it. This is the iPhone moment. This is the next tech wave. This is not the metaverse or blockchain. This is an entirely new, this is like the internet. This is mobile. We were lucky that we had an AI group called the Machine Learning Group back then, led by a guy called Fergal Reid. Fergal's a brilliant, brilliant scientist and business thinker. So we had the right ingredients. We had Owen and Seat as a risk-taking founder before founder mode came back in vogue. And we had the AI group telling us this is the real deal. And we had nothing to lose. We were like, this business is decelerating. So the easier bit was to decide, we're all in on AI. It's going to totally disrupt customer service. To some degree, we're like, nothing to lose. We had 300 million in revenue to lose. But the harder parts were what happened next. The harder part was actually following through and executing the change, because people are change averse and people will say no. Well, they won't say no directly. They'll say no in other ways, like not now, or, well, we need these other things in place before we need to make that kind of a move or that kind of a decision, or our customers won't be ready for this type of thing. So that months after we made the decision to go all in on AI, we started building Finn straight away. Basically, that next week, we started building what was then called a chatbot, and now it's called an agent. But the culture part was the hardest thing, and it was brutal. I don't know how it was for you when you made the change, but really difficult to do and really difficult to pull off. So you need to take huge risks. You need to be able to bet the company and bet the revenue streams you've got already. And then you need to follow through culturally. And honestly, exit people who aren't there for that journey. Bring in people who are and are excited about it. So it was a tough thing to do. It took us maybe 6 to 12 months to fully change the company. Since then, it's been great. We just wrote new values. We changed our mission. Everything from top to bottom was changed.
Just to summarize this for people who may not be as familiar with Intercom, I think you're the most successful refounding, pivoting into AI of any company I know of. You went from $300 million revenue stream that you put at risk to pivot to building AI. And not only has it been successful and maybe the fastest growing, I know that there's been some competitors, maybe copycats, whatever you want to call them. They're different, they have different strategies, but it's really inspiring. I know the pain. So now you ended up with both businesses. So I don't know what I'm allowed to say. I don't know if you know we're an investor in Intercom. So I'll take this out if I'm not allowed to say it. But I think it turned out that your old business is actually not doing as badly as you might have forecasted. So you have actually, maybe by launching the AI business, you've actually refortified the old business and got the new business. Is that the right way to think about it? Or do you have a slightly different way to describe that?
That's a pretty good way to describe it. What happened was we had a human customer service business, but we had AI and we had machine learning technology. We founded the machine learning team in 2015, and we built a thing called Resolution Bot. And it actually worked really well if you set it up and integrated it and actually put in the effort. But the problem was most people just didn't put in the effort. So the machine learning tech was pretty good under the hood, but the setup of it was so onerous. Anyway, so we had history, but the business was really a human customer service business. And when Finn showed up, there was a period where customer service leaders realized it was their job now to explore this type of solution. So they go shopping for products like Finn. And what we found was when they went to buy Finn, they were actually rethinking things almost for first principles. They weren't adding a chatbot to their human support. They were like, wait a minute. Certainly the more future thinking ones were saying, my entire job here is going to change. This entire org I run, this discipline, this industry is going to be turned upside down. So it's kind of like in for a penny, in for a pound. If I'm going to change, I might as well really look at the whole thing. So they then started looking at our human support product, the classic Intercom, and said, actually, it's much better for me if I buy Finn with Intercom because they work seamlessly together versus Finn with a different help desk. So we started to see a lot of customers buy both. And the human support seats business rebounded and it's actually grown pretty well. But, you know, at the same time, it's not the future. And we also took big risky decisions after that, too. We saw the human support business rebound. And yet, because it's not the future of the space, we also went and built what we call Finn standalone internally. But basically, the idea that Finn can work by itself with Zendesk or Salesforce or some other platform that you use, which again is a risky thing to do because we had this rebounding business and there was worry that, hey, well, if we actually ship Finn to work with Zendesk, then all of the customers who might have actually swapped to us from Zendesk will now just take Finn by itself. So again, if you're trying to work out how can we grow the business faster, and it's probably true that because Finn works at Zendesk, I'm sure there are Finn-only customers who stayed on Zendesk who would otherwise have bought Intercom. So we probably lost money in the short term there. But the future is Finn, and the future is agentic customer service. So we'd much rather have more and more Finn customers because that's where the space is going to go. And the Intercom side, the human support side, that product's going to end up changing anyway. So we should get as many Finn customers as we can.
This is going to also be a customer interview. So we, Fundrise, have about 6,000 customer tickets a month. We had 18 people on the investor relations team. We used to have to hire one investor relations person per, I think, 20,000 new investors we got or something. So we have 400,000 investors and 2 million accounts, signups. So the people who are showing up, they require customer service, but the people who are invested require more. God, it must be 18 months ago, or maybe 2 years ago, but a while ago, we adopted Finn. Our organization is more, as you said, future forward than most. Half the team's software programmers, and we're probably not a normal company when it comes to that. And so we rebuilt. We're going through this refounding. Real estate's going to come back where I don't think long-term human-based customer service is going to exist. But for us, we adopted Finn. We put a lot of effort into making sure the resolution rate was good. So I think our resolution rate's higher than your average. I think ours is 94% or something, really high.
Yeah, it's very high.
Our team's kind of obsessive compulsive about these things. And then the whole team changed. This is, again, maybe like a good metaphor for how the whole society changes because you have this change within change within change. Because you have, okay, for our team, I heard you say this somewhere else. Our team loves Finn because they got to get rid of the work that was the most grindy. I'm going to say half the customer service, probably more like 75% was just, oh, I forgot my password. Or like, how does this work? Really simple questions. Or you're like my mom asking questions that if she just Googled it, she could get the answer. So we shed all of that to AI. And then the team could do much more high value of work, white glove work, more strategy. So we ended up with a slightly smaller team. Can't remember how many people, but definitely smaller. We did this math, if I can remember approximately. I think that we ended up with something like cost us $600,000 a year versus Finn costing us $80,000 a year. That's how much we saved. We saved $600,000 of overhead and expense in exchange for basically Finn's cost, which is $70,000 or $80,000 or something. And we always tell your team, charging us too little.
You keep telling them that.
And then to go to the next level inside the organization, what's happening with what's the job of people? What else can we automate? How does the organization change? And we were lucky that the AI work was something people were excited to shed. And we have Zendesk. We still have Zendesk. We didn't rip Zendesk out, even though it's not very good. Zendesk is owned by private equity. They're not investing in the technology. And we want to rip it out. It's just so much work. It's just not a priority. So I think that eventually we'll end up replacing Zendesk, just like you predicted. Actually, Zendesk has a lot of CLO debt out there. There's a lot of private debt funding. They were funded in a take private. And I bet you that debt's trading at a huge discount. So anyways, it's such a good example of all this change we're talking about and how you were like the tip of the sword, essentially, that drove a lot of this change for us.
It's really cool to hear that story. I've loads of thoughts about different parts of that, but for sure, customer service is the canary in the coal mine and Intercom and Finn is, well, I don't know what comes before the canary, but we're definitely like at the bleeding edge and
whatever that is that kills the canary. Carbon monoxide?
Yeah, I don't know. We're that. It's amazing to look for patterns. We've over 7,000 Finn customers. So other companies have different strategies. Some agent providers are very upmarket, so they have a small number of customers, but we're all the way up to the upper mid-market or enterprise. We've over 7,000, and you can look across them, look for patterns, and it's amazing. It's gone through this progression where In the beginning, it's exactly like you described. Finn is doing all the easy stuff, the boring, monotonous stuff, the stuff that makes the job just terrible. People quit. Customer service team, his biggest problems is staff turnover. People just quit. The job sucks. So all that stuff went away pretty quickly. And then the humans are doing the complex questions. But now Finn is really good at complex work too. The models have gotten way better. People have learned how to make them better through experimentation and trial and error. They started to hook, their trust has increased. They started to hook them into their business systems and write to the systems and read sensitive customer data and so on. So now Finn's doing really complex work, very impressive stuff when you look at customer conversation examples. Then you're like, well, what did the people do now? And the people are now doing different things entirely. So one cohort are doing new jobs that never existed before, like orchestration of the agent and designing the agent. How should the agent actually behave? Someone needs to figure that out. Knowledge needs to be kept up to date. Finn can only be as good as the knowledge and the data it has access to and how good that is. So there's new types of jobs that have emerged. And then people have been redeployed to other things that the company couldn't afford to do. Like you said, white glove service or customer success. These are things that companies wanted to do but couldn't afford it. Or voice as a channel. They wanted phone for VIPs, but phone is like really, really expensive. So people are like, we could never have afforded phone before, but now we can because Finn works over phone too. So maybe that won't be very durable. But for now, people are like, yeah, the VIPs get us the direct line 24/7, 365, human to human. It's part of our offering. So it's been amazing to see the change. It's happened so rapidly. Finn's only 3 years old and it continues. The capabilities these days are mind-blowing. I think people using Finn are still catching up to what it can do.
This is such a great, because I think most people aren't living AI the way you and I are. And I was listening to Jack Clark from Anthropic on Ezra Klein yesterday, and his examples of how they're using AI inside were so not very compelling. I feel like they have a hard time explaining to everyone else why it's going to be so effective. And I think this is actually maybe easier example.
Yeah, it's very relatable. I also say to people that no one wakes up in the morning and thinks, I can't wait to talk to that business about my problem today. Consumers and people don't want to do customer service. I say that with all the love for people working in customer service teams, but they want the problem resolved and they want to move on with their life. So everyone has had this experience. So it's very relatable. Everyone's been overcharged. Everyone's been shipped the wrong thing. Everyone's wanted to try and change plan, but couldn't. We all know what it feels like to get really terrible service. And what's really cool is we updated our mission recently because one of the things with AI is a lot of people are still in the mode that, especially if the mass market, people not working in tech are in the mode that AI will help me do the thing I do already better or faster. But actually, AI is going to make you be able to do things that you were never possible before. And we actually think with customer service, for the most part, is still pretty bad around the world. The economics don't work. You can't just keep throwing human capital, like increasing volumes of customer conversations. So now, though, not only can it finish the results of queries, finish the job for people, it can actually elevate to a thing that was never possible before, which we say is perfect customer service. The idea that every customer, every single time, will get the perfect experience. It's aspirational still, but I think it's a tractable thing. I think it's a possible thing that whatever the query might be, whatever shape it took, or some people want immediate resolution, don't care if it's cold, get on with their life. Other people want a bit of love. They're a loyal customer on the like premium plan for 10 years. Everyone will get the experience where they turn around and say, yeah, that's perfect. I wouldn't change it. So I think AI is going to enable us to do things that weren't economically feasible before. I think that's really exciting.
I want to talk about that because I literally lived experiences, as they say. So before I do, I just want to explain something. You said read and write to the database. And I think people don't know what that means. I want to give a really good example. So my torture in customer service is we once were flying to Utah Christmas morning and our flight was delayed because of snow. I had to change my flight and I called Delta. The wait time was 12 hours. And then I went on their chatbot, which was basically pretty bad. So the read of a database is that the chatbot tells me what flights are available. It can read the information and tell me about it. And the write is I can say, okay, that's the flight I want to change my ticket and charge my credit card the difference. So it's the action changing what is in the database is writing the database. And that's very different for people who don't know about cybersecurity because you worry that AI might write the wrong thing or do something that you wouldn't want it to do. And that can be a lot of possibilities, like deleting things and things like that. So reading the database, read-only is very easy in software, and writing is much more risky. So to be able to go from reading to writing is a big change of possibilities.
It's huge. And it's funny, another thing I end up talking to people about is people ask me often about hallucinations, which is the idea that AI makes stuff up and it's inaccurate. And we've worked very hard in Finn's hallucination rate, making sure it's really low. And we've gotten it right down. We've all sorts of checks and balances in the system where the system will generate an answer and then it will check it all sorts of different ways to make sure it is actually the right answer. But I have to remind people too that people hallucinate. People make stuff up. People lie. And people can write bad stuff to systems too, by accident or as part of just trying to get their job done. I remember many, many years ago, same as you, I grew up in the early internet and my background's design. I worked in user experience consultancy, but I remember I did an ethnography project for Vodafone, one of the biggest mobile operators. And I was in their call center and people are ethnography. It's like observing people in their actual daily environment and seeing what they behave like. Anyway, this call center was nuts. This was the Vodafone call center for their customer service line. It was crazy in there. People were like, please hold. Like, hey, does anyone know? I don't know the answers. And, you know, people are like asking each other, writing post-it notes. No one's looking up anything. So customers are getting all sorts of different types of answers, inconsistent, inaccurate. So I think another thing with the psychology of AI is that we hold it to this insane standard that you'd never hold humans to. And actually, if you compare apples to apples, the AI performance is incredible. It's much better in lots of different domains. So that's another thing we're going to have to work through. But the reading and the writing thing, like you said, it's riskier. But these days, I think it's getting quite reliable.
We have a real estate AI product I meant called realai.com. And what I've learned, I've watched, is if information is in a paragraph, people don't believe it. If information is in a table, they think it comes from God.
Exactly. It's so funny. English and maths, basically.
Yeah. And, you know, for us and probably for you too, when we wanted to do things that are facts, because real estate is a lot of numbers, it's actually reading out of a deterministic database. It's opening up a software sandbox. It's not actually AI. AI is opening up traditional software sandbox and writing software and programming it and then sticking the information into the interface so that people can get the facts. Our product, we don't really use traditional RAG. We don't use a vector database for most stuff. But anyway, I always want to say that because some of my customers are listening and I got to make sure I keep them on track.
We have determinism built into Finn too. It's really important. There's times where it's absolutely critical that Finn says exactly these words. We have loads of customers in regulated industries, banking and health. So actually, Finn does both. The agentic, it's prop generative and probabilistic like AI is, and then it's deterministic together. And it's really cool. It's very powerful, but we have tables too, are the equivalent to that.
To people, it's all mixed together in a soup, so they can't see the ingredients. But I want to go back to this analogy we're playing out for how AI is going to change society. And I feel like it's customer services are great in a microcosm. So, okay, you have people, they were doing annoying customer service. They went and did white glove. What happened for us, and I think what's going to be the positive shock to society, is that you're only bounded by your imagination. So we started to do all sorts of new things. We launched new businesses, the team went and started doing sales. Obviously, there's a lot of AI work, AI orchestration and AI monitoring, AI improvements. So really capable people can do if you have ambition and are entrepreneurial about things. That's what we did. But I can see a lot of organizations not doing that.
People change slowly. Technology changes fast. I'll tell you about my experience with Claude Code. I can't code. I'm not a coder. I'm a designer. As a product manager, I'm a product-y person, not an engineer or developer. Barely could write HTML back in the day. And Claude Code, you kind of use it through terminal, an app on your Mac that's hardcore, nerdery. So it's intimidating. And for the longest time, Claude Code's only a year old. But for the first 6 months, I was a bit like, don't really know what to do here, out of my depth. And like, if you fast forward to today, I just had a go. And what it can do is, it's like magic technology. I'll just give you a simple example. We had a product launch this week. So did the usual thing, videoed the product launch. I was like this talking into the camera, whatever. There was like a snippet in the product launch that I wanted to take out, excerpt, and then share it on LinkedIn. So Claude Code's natural language. The brand is probably misleading to some degree. So I just typed in, hey, can you go to this website page, this video at the top, and I need a clip that talks about the Finn flywheel, which is a part of the Finn product. starts around 2:11, ends around 2:40. That was it. That was the prompt. And 2 minutes later, Claude had done its thing, and there was an MP4 file on my desktop, and it was perfect of that clip. Perfect. And I uploaded it to LinkedIn this morning. The thing about that is, like, it was just magic. It just literally worked by magic. And I never would have done it otherwise. Just the idea of, oh, open QuickTime or download a file, or I just asked God to do it. So I think it's very, very true that it's the limits of your imagination.
I love your accent, because I can't tell if you said Claude or God.
Yeah, feels like God to me, honestly.
It's so interesting to me too, because you and I are like building with it and living with it. And yet there's really no major consumer application where what you're saying, the lag to the mainstream is so massive. Such an interesting dynamic. I guess this always happens in all things, but I had a guy from Anthropic on my podcast last week. And the thing I was getting from it is, because their economic model is so different, you and I, we have to always live this iterative back and forth between product market fit and product market progress. And they can free solo. They don't really need the product market fit to constrain them. So they're way ahead of the market at this point, because the way their economics are, OpenAI announced they raised $110 billion today.
Well, I didn't hear that.
This problem of people move slow and technology move fast is now 10x to 100x. I think it creates all these opportunities and challenges. I would love to hear your stylized scenario. Tell me how you think we end 26, we end 27, 8, a 1-3-5 year. You could have multiple versions of it. You live it. How do you think it plays out? Do you have like two versions of how you think the world's likely to look?
I have ideas. When you're asking that question, I think a chart from the Wall Street Journal last week, I think it was Wall Street Journal, AI is going to keep getting better. There's like, or some version of will you live in a simulation, probably, or like extinction. I was like, oh my God. So this is like, I have this dual life where like my X feed is full of this stuff. And most of my friends don't work in technology. They work in banks. My siblings are teachers. So I actually think about this quite a lot. And again, the only answer I have is I really don't know. But if I was to guess, I don't think more than a year ahead, honestly. And neither does Intercom. We think about our company strategy, business strategy. Our product roadmap goes out about 3 to 6 months, which for a scaled company of our size, with exponentially growing Fin product nearing 100 million, 300 million SaaS product, to not think more than 3 months ahead or 6 months ahead is not the norm. But what's happening next Christmas? None of us know. Claude Code is less than a year old, or just a year old, I think. So what I think will probably happen is the technology is going to keep getting better and better. I think there's going to be lots of people who are going to see huge success from being early to adopt it. I think there's probably going to be a period of pain, real pain, like the Block example. Let's assume what's interesting, the Block story with the layoffs is, even if it wasn't AI and it was like some version of overhiring, a story like that's coming at some time. There's some companies going to say, hey, we've cracked the code. Yeah, we actually don't need the company to size. Half the size will do, or a fifth of the size will do in a dramatic scenario. So I do think there's going to be stories like that. I do think there's going to be tremendous pain, but I'm a delusional optimist. I'm not a doomer. We put a lot of effort into educating our customers, educating the market. We have a thing called Blueprint, which is like the blueprint for AI transformation. We love teaching. We're kind of teachers in our DNA. And I'm optimistic that a lot of the people who maybe get laid off because of AI change or companies downsizing actually have a new opportunity to build companies themselves and realize that actually tools like Claude Code, they can build software and it's really easy to do. It's way easier than they might have realized. So I think we're going to see maybe like if the internet created the Etsy's of the world and lots of people suddenly could make a living doing something that they were passionate about. I'm optimistic that AI will see some similar pattern where you'll see a lot more very, very, very small businesses who can make actually quite a living doing it. But, you know, I'm not sure. And I think we're going to see some tough pain and people trying to retrain, relearn along the way.
You're in Ireland. I'm in the United States. How do you think about the differences between countries on this topic?
It used to be the case that the EU were very, very far behind the US and China. That's probably still true. Things like regulation have not helped innovation. It's stifled innovation. And I think that the attitude of the EU is changing. So I think a lot of countries like Ireland are somewhat constrained by being in the EU. And then I think within the country itself, you're going to see pockets. I've been going back to San Francisco more often recently because it's the epicenter. at least in the Western world, the epicenter of AI. And it's crazy. It's like living in the future. I don't know what Washington's like, but I'm sure other parts of the US, most people, they use AI like the better version of Google. I don't know if the country-to-country change will matter so much as the subsections of the population in each country. But is there something you're thinking about there, a culture or...
No, I mean, I used to travel a lot internationally. I lived in Copenhagen years ago.
Oh, very cool.
It was so fun. I lived in Copenhagen during the George W. Bush era when the US was invading Iraq. It just having a view of what the international community thought of us was a helpful perspective. And so, like, I'm on X as well. It's such a weird little community. And so it's how behind is Europe really? I don't really believe them when they say it's so far behind. I'm skeptical about that. I was curious. I mean, Ireland's not representative. I mean, whatever, not always. The last 20 years is Tiger. So it's been the cutting edge of Europe, or one of the cutting edges.
I think one way to think about it might be, like Intercom being founded in Ireland, technically we're a US company. You know, we just have four Irish founders, and we're dual. We're like a US-Irish company. We're definitely an anomaly in Ireland, a breakout technology company. But if you look around Europe, the US has multiple labs. I mean, obviously OpenAI and Anthropic are the two biggest. And China has a whole bunch of stuff going on, DeepSeek and Qwen, and Europe as Mistral. But that's how I look at these things. I'm looking for where are the breakout technology companies coming from? And Europe certainly has some, like Dust in Paris. And there's some cool companies being built in Europe for sure. But I think a lot of people in Europe who have high ambition in technology just move to the States. They move to San Francisco. And I think you'll find a lot of European founders in San Francisco, and they move because that's the center. It's where the capital is. Most of the capital is and all that kind of thing. Access to people, resources.
I mean, as you said it, when I go often. It is like in the future of the driverless cars. There's all these different kinds of driverless cars. I love driverless is another good metaphor because I'm in Washington, D.C., and Waymo is going to roll out here, and the city council members just started stopping it. And I don't know exactly. It feels like a stick up to me, but it's nonsense. And so there's all this resistance to positive change. And you go to San Francisco and there's so much optimism. That's what's so fun. I mean, Washington, D.C., it's got to be one of the most pessimistic places in the country today. The right hates it. The left hates it. Everybody hates Washington, D.C. today. It's just depressing. So it's fun to be someplace where people literally think they're inventing something that's going to make everybody rich and free and happy.
I like going there too, for the same reasons you do. But again, I go back to this idea of some kind of dual life I lead. Most people I speak to, most of my friends, family, don't understand any of this stuff. And they're scared and anxious. And I think a lot of people are anxious about what's going to happen, very understandably. I personally think it's going to be net positive. We might see things like curing cancer within our lifetimes. I think we'll see breakthroughs like that, which is incredible for humanity if we can do something like that. But in the short term, people have mortgages to pay and families to feed. And when you see things like knowledge work will be done by AI, it's scary. So I think it's important that people have perspective and can hold both ideas in their head. Because again, I know it's a cop-out to some degree. I just keep telling people lately, I don't know. 6 months? I don't know. 12 months? I don't know. We really don't know. That's why the crazy stupid chart being extinct or super intelligence is came from. So in the meantime, I think it's important to retain balance and perspective from both sides.
I think even crazier is that actually it's up to us. It's not like something happening outside our control, like a meteorite or something. There's so much agency in it. And I think that's part of what freaks people out.
Maybe people are worried too that in theory, we're in control. And yet there's kind of a race to AGI, maybe a race to super intelligence. So the train's left the station and actually all we can do now is try and ensure we govern it well and manage it properly and try and put boundaries or constraints on it in ways that help humans. So I don't think it's going to stop. I think the only way it's stopping is energy constraints and stuff like that.
I have a slightly different view. I sort of think of it as, it's sort of like evolution. Human beings weren't inevitable. We could have had different genetic mutations and Neanderthals could rule the earth. What is superintelligence exactly? That's not written in the stars. There's probably will be different kinds, different personalities, different values, different everything. And so I think there is a much bigger range possibility. And depending on some luck and some good decisions, we end up in a very different world. So
I think that's true. I guess the inevitability for me is some version of this future is going to play out. But like you said, there's a range of possibilities there. Huge, massive, huge range.
But being constructive about it is being thoughtful, being prudent, but being constructive is way more likely to get a good outcome.
That makes sense.
Well, anyways, we got way off, far from the application layer here, but I really appreciate you coming on the show. I think you guys are doing awesome work. Everybody should adopt Intercom. We did, and hope you get some more sun in Ireland soon.
Thanks, Ben. Yeah, appreciate it. It was fun to talk to you. It was great. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, Onward.
You've been listening to Onward, featuring Paul Adams, Chief Product Officer at Intercom. My name is Ben Miller, CEO of Fundrise. We invite you again to please send your comments and questions to onward@fundrise.com. If you like what you've heard, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Be sure to follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. For more information on Fundrise sponsored investment products, including relevant legal disclaimers, check out our show notes. Thanks so much for joining me.